Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. It's been more than two decades now since the September 11th attacks made the word terrorism a dominant topic in American policy and politics. And while strong disagreement remains as to the wisdom of the so-called war on terror our nation conducted in response, one thing almost all Americans would have thought unimaginable during most of the last 21 years is the situation we confront today. As Duke University professor and terrorism expert David Shanzer explained to me in a conversation we had earlier this week, the top present-day terrorism threat in our country comes not from abroad, but from domestic extremists, disaffected and delusional people like those who invaded the U.S. Capitol last January 6th. In part one of our chat, we discussed how this transition, the demise of the emphasis on combating Islamic extremism and the rise of domestic terror, came about.
Well, Professor David Shanzer, welcome back to News and Views. Thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be with you.
You've got this new newsletter that's been recently launched. You've entitled it, and I want to ask you a lot of questions about terrorism and the terror threat, foreign and domestic, but I want to ask about the new newsletter, Perilous Times. Talk to us about why you chose that title for it. I guess maybe in some ways it seems self-evident, but perhaps you could expand upon that a bit.
Well, I think we do live in perilous times, and the reason for the newsletter is to try to be involved in the debate about the issues that are threatening. When I grew up, I was never thinking about whether American democracy would survive in its current form. That was really not even a subject of debate. And matter of fact, the Cold War ended and democracy was spreading all around Europe. The Soviet Union disappeared. It looked like it was going to be the century of continued democracy promotion. So what we've seen is really democracy declining really all around the world. And then the rise of Russia and China and their aggressiveness and the rise of China economically. So this kind of counterweight of authoritarianism affecting much of the world. And then, of course, our own institutions, showing fragility, the election of a president who did not accept a lot of the norms of democracy that had been accepted by all presidents of all parties, since the Civil War, which is that you count the votes and then the election results in a peaceful transition of power. So all those things, I think, have made these very perilous times, and it's worth discussing and also talking about ways that we might reform and change our laws and institutions to make our democracy more secure.
It's a must read if you're interested in this topic, and one would hope that most Americans are. I want to get into a lot of those topics you've been dealing with recently, but I do want to take note of the fact that we've just passed the 21st anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and we've now had more than two decades of this, I guess we called it the war on terror and America's conflict with Islamic extremism. Is it over? Is it quaint? Are we in a new phase? Does it seem sort of yesterday's news in this world we inhabit today?
Yeah, I think we'd be making a big mistake to say it's over and take our eye entirely off the ball. And I don't believe our government is. But it's a very good thing that it doesn't dominate our news, dominate the way we think about foreign policy, and so on. So that is definitely a sign of success. The groups that engage in the attack and those who share their ideology, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, like-minded organizations, definitely still exist. They present problems in many parts of the world, Afghanistan, definitely parts of Africa. I think our government continues to be very concerned about. The threat to the homeland and to U.S. interests is much lower than it was 20 years ago or even maybe 10 years ago, but that doesn't mean it's non-existent. The good news is that we have organizations and institutions that have either been created since 9/11, things like the Department of Homeland Security, the National Security Division, the Justice Department, the National Security Division in the FBI, the National Counterterrorism Center, the National Director of Intelligence. None of these institutions even existed, and they still have as one of their core purposes to prevent acts of terrorism in the United States. So that while reporters and the public does not have to be as much invested in this issue as we've been for the past 20 years, those organizations still are. Again, this could change in a moment, and it doesn't take many people to create bad damage. That's the nature of terrorism. So I don't want to underplay it, but I think security-wise, you know, from this particular threat, we're in a much better situation than we were. And we're talking less about the 21st anniversary than we were for many, many of these years. And I think that's a good thing.
Do you have any concerns about what the war on terror has done to sort of American concepts of justice and due process? There's still folks in Guantanamo who are still in prison there. Many have still not actually ever been tried. We know that our government has participated in activities of basically seizing people overseas and imprisoning them. Do you have any concerns about that? Should Americans have concerns about that?
You know, this is not different from a lot of times of war where mistakes are made, government powers expand without sufficient oversight. Things are identified. There are scandals, sometimes court cases, sometimes pushback from the public, and then we tend to recover and we admit that mistakes were made and then try to maybe, you know, reform institutions to change them. You know, so I think the CIA program of torture that was used didn't really help us fight Al-Qaeda very much and, you know, was a stain on America and American principles. So it was a terrible mistake. You know, it's not like other people who are responsible have gone to jail. We've had certainly forms of accountability that have been imposed on the architects and the politicians that allowed that program to go forward. I think we're kind of done with that accountability. You know, Guantanamo is a little trickier. By and large, the legal structure, although many people internationally disagree with it, it's been blessed by the Supreme Court. It's been blessed by the Congress. Now, President Obama and Bush reduced the population substantially. You know, we're down to close to 24 people who are still there. So I don't see it as a, you know, dominating problem that it once was, although it is still a lingering issue.
We're talking to Professor David Shanzer of Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. He's the director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. And he also holds forth on the issues of the day at the newsletter Perilous Times. I guess I want to turn an issue that you've been, of course, writing a lot about and paying a lot of attention to in recent years and months, and that's the whole issue of homegrown domestic terrorism. We noted earlier this year we had the one-year anniversary of January 6th insurrection. Donald Trump using incendiary rhetoric to stoke violence and really attempt to overturn a legitimate election. Have we seen any hopeful progress on this front, or does this continue to be a grave concern about for the future of our country?
Well, at Duke, we just had a visit last week from one of the lead Justice Department attorneys who deals with the issue of domestic terrorism. He has the title of Counsel for Domestic Terrorism in the National Security Division of the Justice Department. Again, such a position, you know, didn't exist 10 years ago. So because of the change in the nature of the threat, our institutions have had to respond. He noted that inside the homeland that the FBI and the Justice Department assess the threat from a racially motivated extremist and anti-government extremist to be the two sources that were of highest threat and most concern to our law enforcement authorities. So that is, you know, if you look at compared to 20 years ago when we were just talking about Al-Qaeda, that's a real sea change. And I think what we've seen in the, you know, since really, especially since January 6th and the changeover to the Biden administration, is more attention and emphasis and resources being put towards that threat than had been done. Although the visitor did say some changes that were made even during the Trump administration that helped direct more attention to this element of the threat as well. So, yes, it's very much of a concern. I do think that the intense Justice Department investigation, and I believe it's now over 800 prosecutions, and I'm not aware of any of them that have not led to convictions, and there have been various jail sentences of different lengths imposed. I think that has had a, you know, really substantial deterrent effect on additional actions. But the issue is that the grievances that drive this ideology, as you've pointed out, have been stoked and are very deeply, you know, opinion polls show that they're very deeply accepted. And so grievance can turn to violence pretty quickly. So in some ways, It's almost like the situation with the forest fires. We have a lot of dry tinder in the woods, and it doesn't take much more than a flash of lightning to set off the fire. And I think that's the situation we're in right now.
Some of that dry tinder might be the modern conservative movement in America. You wrote recently about how the line between the American conservative movement and what you describe as white Christian nationalism has in many respects sort of evaporated. It's really the conservative movement has been transformed in our country. And I wonder if that is an area of concern as well.
Well, it certainly is. Everybody has a right to have their political views, and I certainly accept that. Traditional conservatism dealt with, expanding free markets, promoting religious liberty, reduced government, less regulation on business, and we all had political debates about that, and people could agree and disagree, but we shared a lot of, whether it was liberal, conservative, moderate, shared a commitment to free elections, shared a commitment to, as I said, religious liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, free and fair elections, promoting democracy abroad. And I think the article you point out was, when Viktor Orban, the multiple time, I think three-time elected leader of Hungary, came to the conservative conference. And he has crushed the free press in Hungary. He has undercut civil society institutions that disagreed with his view. He has, promoted kind of Christianity as a national ethos, therefore kind of demeaning other minorities and reducing their rights. And he's crushed opposition movements. So he's very anti-democratic and espouses these views, quite openly and clearly. And the notion that this autocrat would be embraced by the modern conservative movement was certainly, again, something I wouldn't have ever anticipated having seen, when I was the age of my students. And so that is what is disturbing to me. It's not the difference of political views between different Americans. That's healthy, and that's what we expect in a democracy. It's the embrace of some modern conservatives, not about tax rates, but about the fundamental ways our society is structured and commitment to democracy that really bothers me.
You said that the robust response to the January 6th insurrection that's resulted in a lot of prosecutions and convictions has had a good deterrent effect. Do you still harbor any concerns about what's going to happen this November or maybe even in the election in 2024 with groups like Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and Three Percenters? Is that still a threat that there could be violence, that there could be efforts to overturn elections?
Well, I think the bigger threat to elections is some of the candidates that are running for office, whether some local offices or some as high as Secretary of State and Governor, people who will have, if they are elected, responsibility for ensuring free and fair elections, who continue to argue about Stop the Steal. And seem to espouse the notion that any election that doesn't result in their victory and their taking or retention of power are by definition fraudulent and tainted. That is a disturbing idea in American politics. It certainly has started with Trump really almost in the 2016 campaign, and then he surprised himself and won. And then, of course, in 2020, before the votes were even counted, of course, after the January 6th, and then since, such the extent that a large swath of the American public doesn't accept that the results of the election were fairly counted. And another poll showed that, not only that 7% of the population polled thinks not only that President Biden was not the legitimate president, but that violence is justified to remove him from power. That's a staggering number of people. So, yes, there is potential for problems out in the world. I do think these groups have been kind of stymied by the law enforcement reaction to January 6th. I think they're concerned about, search warrants, subpoenas, and so on. Of course, they have democratic rights and the freedom to continue to organize and espouse their views, and I support that. But what they don't have the right to do is organize and to, threaten and foment violence. And so I think I was quite heartened by our Justice Department visitor last week, who really showed a very close attentiveness to that line. And despite these threats that we're seeing from, you know, these kind of racially motivated terrorists or anti-government terrorists, that our authorities very much understand that they have a right to exist, they have a right to have their views, and they're watching very carefully in the event that they cross the line to threatening or planning or engaging in violence. And that's what's illegal. So, you know, we can cross our fingers and hope, and let's wait and see.
Coming up next, part two of my special extended conversation with Professor David Shanzer. Stay with us.
Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. In part one of my special extended conversation with Duke University professor and terrorism expert David Shanzer, we reviewed some of the history of America's global war on terror that took place in the years that followed the attacks on September 11, 2001. In part two of our conversation, we dug into several aspects of the top terror threat facing our country in 2022, the rise of domestic right-wing extremism like that which gave rise to the January 6, 2021 invasion of the U.S. Capitol. And as Shanzer told me, while recent law enforcement actions like the prosecution of hundreds of January 6th insurrection participants has almost certainly had an important deterrent effect, the challenge to our country remains significant, especially as more and more once mainstream conservative groups embrace the disturbing rise of white Christian nationalism.
Professor, one of the big issues, of course, that's in public debate these days is the aftermath of January 6th and the actions of former President Trump. There are proceedings in different places looking into whether Trump should be prosecuted, perhaps for his actions in Georgia in trying to overturn the legitimate election there, perhaps with respect to his actions on January 6th. What's your assessment on whether this is a productive path for prosecutors to pursue or whether it poses some risks to our country?
Well, some of my writings have suggested I'm torn. You know, the rule of law in a democracy is primary. And the idea of the rule of law is that people who break the rule of law are punished and investigated. The rule of law needs to be applied fairly to everyone. So there's no ex-president exception to the criminal law. Not every crime is prosecuted, and prosecutors have a lot of discretion as to when to bring a prosecution. And those kind of precedents are laid out in Justice Department manuals and live in the institutional memory of the people who've worked there for many decades. And it's very important that we apply the same standards of prosecutorial discretion. So, you know, I think it's very appropriate. Look at the Hillary Clinton case. It involved classified documents for a presidential candidate. We have to make sure that Trump is being treated the same with the same standards as Hillary Clinton was in that instance. That's what the rule of law is. And that's paramount. But we also have a second democratic tradition, which is a peaceful transition of power and the notion that we let elections end, let bygones be bygones. We don't try to look at all the things that we might have disagreed with that the prior administration had done and try to punish those who pursued policies and so on that we didn't disagree with. We see that kind of instability in a place like Pakistan, where, you know, if you look at the prime ministers and presidents of Pakistan, how many of them are then prosecuted for fraud and so on. And that's a very troubling precedent that would be set if we actually sent not only a former president, but a president, a person who has said they want to, you know, run again. You know, I think we have to put ourselves in the shoes of an avid Trump supporter who might see a prosecution and potential jailing of their preferred candidate for president and see how they would see that as highly anti-democratic, not letting the voters decide, but essentially, you know, maybe letting a forum shopped jury, you know, in a highly all these prosecutions are taking place in Democratic strongholds, you know, the Biden Justice Department, New York City DA and an attorney general, the Fulton County, Atlanta, another Democratic institution run shop. So all of these things should be investigated to the hilt. I think anybody who aided and abetted any of these activities and engaged in crime there's much less problem with prosecuting them. You know, whether or not we want to prosecute, whether it's appropriate to prosecute Trump himself, you know, for these reasons, I'm torn. It really depends on the strength of the evidence and the demonstration that there is, you know, intentional action. And I think it's actually a very, very tough call. But in terms of anybody else, and these are sweeping investigations now, we've, you know, learned about 5 or 6 dozen subpoenas that have gone out to various Trump campaign officials, associates, and so on. Again, I think we'll probably learn more after the election. I don't think we're going to see a lot of action, indictments or anything of the sort, close to the election this midterm. So those are the values that are at stake. And that's, you know, again, why we're in such troubled times and perilous times, because these are kind of hard issues for our democracy to manage.
So we come to the end of our time with Professor David Chandser. I guess that's an apt question, apt follow-up, as we talk about sort of this tightrope that prosecutors have to walk, this fine line between going too far and endangering our country and bringing people to justice. There's also this fine line, it seems, that the president, President Biden, is trying to walk in terms of being critical of so-called MAGA Republicans and at the same calling for unity in our country. I wonder, do you have any hope that we can find that sense of unity again? I mean, our nation has made radical changes in the past over short periods of time. Is there still grounds for hope that that can happen again?
You know, I think every president in my recent memory has used their inaugural address to try to call for unity of one sort or another. Now, of course, that's a natural thing to do after a divisive election. But I think the more recent calls, you know, Bush, Obama, Biden, was a, you know, this idea that our country is not as unified as it once was on shared values and just our feelings of fellowship towards each other have been eroding. And the president's come into office saying we need to try to fix that, and I'm going to be dedicated to that. And then, of course, the imperatives of politics, you know, start and you get to an election. And how do you, you know, both lead the country and then try to stay in power and win an election? Many would like our leaders to rise above that. But, you know, that's tough to do when all the people who have supported you and are spending money and contributing to candidates want you to be out there to try to win an election. And the president is both the president and the leader of his political party at the same time. So that creates that kind of tension. So I think you're referring to the president's speech. I think it is right for the president to point out threats to our very democracy, what he says, the fight for the soul of America. And I think it's also because of the extraordinary nature of the Trump presidency and the things that Trump did, not only possibly breaking the law, but breaking all these norms of what we expect from a leader that aren't written into the Constitution, but are important part of our foundation of democracy. You know, accepting freedom of the press, extolling the virtue of free and fair elections, and so on. And there are many others. I think Biden is right to point that out. I think what is problematic is when we kind of mix that with trying to rally the troops on issues like abortion or legislation for climate change. It would have been better if, you know, those kinds of issues were kept out of the speech and we focused more on these things relating explicitly to democratic values. So I think that's where Biden might have erred, and a little bit too much of mixing of kind of pro-democracy and regular old politics. But I do think it's important for him to be speaking to, you know, all the issues that we've discussed today and the condition of our country and the challenges that we're facing.
Professor David Chandser of Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. He's the director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. You can read his takes on the issues of the day in the online Substack newsletter, Perilous Times. Professor Chandser, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work for our country, and please stay safe and take care.
Rob, thank you for having me, and thank you for all the listeners.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Remember, you can check us out online and subscribe for free to some of our state's best news coverage and political commentary at ncpolicywatch.com. You can also listen to all of our interviews and commentaries on Apple Podcasts. For producer Clayton Henkel, this is Rob Schofield. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.